You are listening to the Cycling Podcast, brought to you by Sports Tours International. We're very proud to have been sponsored by Sports Tours International over the past couple of months, as the racing season has cranked into top gear. Sports Tours International can take you on the cycling trip of a lifetime, whether you want to ride one of the great sportives or watch the biggest races from the roadside. They have packages to get you on the start line of some of the biggest and most prestigious sportives in Europe, including the Étape du Tour, the Étape du Tour de France Femmes, which makes its debut later this year, La Marmotte in France, the Maratona in Italy, and the Mallorca 312. Perhaps you're more of a classic specialist and you want to combine riding the cobblestones with watching the Tour of Flanders and Paris-Roubaix. Sports Tours International can take you right to the heart of the action. There's also a range of packages to watch the Tour de France. You could go and see the Grand Départ in Lille, or watch the race in the Alps, the Pyrenees, or on Mont Ventoux. Or perhaps watching the spectacular finale with a glass of champagne in your hand is more your style. Sports Tours International team of friendly, knowledgeable guides will ensure an unforgettable trip where you'll meet like-minded cycling fans. Friend of the podcast Jill Price has written in to say she's been on a number of Sports Tours International trips over the years and they've all been excellent. She's seen the Tour de France from an official car, enjoyed the VIP experience in a helicopter, and seen the race on the Champs-Élysées. Check out the full range of trips at sportstoursinternational.co.uk. We'd like to say a big thank you to Sports Tours International for supporting the cycling podcast. And now it's on with the show.
You are listening to the Cycling Podcast.
Hello and joining you on March the 17th, St. Patrick's Day, after a weekend when, in the key moment of Paris-Nice, as the race was decided on the cold airs, we saw Larry Warbus's house, Larry Warbus's girlfriend, Larry Warbus's dog, and two other American riders marauding clear, proudly hoisting the stars and stripes above the Côte d'Azur. My name is Daniel Freeber. I'm the host of this episode of the Cycling Podcast, which will be partly dedicated to finding out where Larry Warbus himself was on Sunday and what exactly he was doing. Joining me to offer assistance in that endeavour, conveniently, is Larry Warbus.
How you doing?
Who I believe has now returned to his castle on the cold airs. Hello, Larry.
Hey, I'm back home, yeah.
Already sunning himself on the balcony.
Exactly. I'm, you know, just absorbing this sunshine that they didn't get the chance to absorb for most of Paris-Nice.
And Larry, well, you weren't a Paris-Nice, but I am right, aren't I? The race did go well. You live in a little sort of cul-de-sac just off the cold airs, but we could pretty, if we sort of squinted, if we strained, we could see your palace.
They did pass the road in front of my house, yeah.
Yes, and your girlfriend was there and your dog was there.
Exactly.
Chaps, I need to think long and hard. I'll introduce Lionel in just a second. I need to think. I'll introduce him now. Lionel, joining us from his shed in not Watford.
Hello, Daniel. Lionel, yeah, my house sadly is not on the route of the race to the sun or Tirreno Adriatico either. It's here in the edge of the Chilterns, just about.
Mm. Or indeed in the sun. Talking of dogs, I need to think long and hard about whether I want to alienate about 50% of our listeners with strong opinions about some social media content I saw from Tirreno Adriatico involving dogs. Do either of you know what I'm talking about?
I mean, I guess it's Ayuso and his dog, but...
We'll move on and I'll ponder, I'll have a long, hard think about what I want to say. This issue, incidentally, has already been raised with the UAE social media team at Paris-Nice at the weekend. My strong opinions were voiced in their direction. Anyway, chaps, how are we? How are you, Lionel?
Very well, thank you. Are you alienating all dog lovers? Was that the risk here?
Dogs on, how do we feel about dogs on podiums? Dogs licking race winners vigorously.
Yeah, I remember Adam Yates's dog dressed up in the yellow jersey at the Tour de France in the Basque Country. You don't mind that? That's all right.
I don't mind that. It's the face licking that I've got a problem with. It's the hygiene.
I'm sure they're all very clean dogs.
I might be alienating Larry here. Larry's looking very unimpressed with this. Larry's a big dog lover.
I am. But I mean, you know, to each their own. That's okay. You don't have to love dogs.
Anyway, chaps, it is St. Patrick's Day. Important day for Lionel and me. We are, of course, officially Irish. Important weekend of racing. As we all know, Paris-Nice concluded at the weekend. Tirreno Adriatico concluded yesterday as well. If I haven't already mentioned it, Larry, that's where you have spent your last week. We're going to be hearing all about that. We're going to be hearing about Paris-Nice. I was there for ITV. Lionel, you were observing all of it, digesting all of it. But, Lionel, what else has been in the news in professional cycling this week? It's time for the Newsette.
The Newsette. Well, my story this week, Daniel, concerns the 23-year-old German rider, Michael Hessmann, who was third overall in the Tour de l'Avenir a few years ago and turned professional for the Jumbo-Visma team. In August 2023, he returned an adverse analytical finding in an anti-doping test which found very small traces of a banned substance called chlorthalidone, which is a diuretic that's banned both in and out of competition. Now, he put forward the defence saying that he'd not taken this substance knowingly, and the National Anti-Doping Agency of Germany found that that was a plausible defence and upheld the contention that it could have been in contaminated medication such as paracetamol or ibuprofen. So they gave him a 4-month ban. Now, the World Anti-Doping Agency cited the strict liability rule, which is that an athlete is responsible for any substance that's found in their system, and they objected to that lenient penalty. And there was a bit of to and fro between Hessmann's legal team and WADA, and in the end, they reached a settlement, which was effectively a 21-month suspension with a clause enabling Hessmann to train with a new team for 2 months before becoming eligible to race again. So on January the 15th this year, he signed for Movistar, and his ban expired on Friday, and on Wednesday he'll line up and make his debut for Movistar at Milano Torino, which will be his first race in 18 months. Now, the reason this case caught my eye is because it really mirrors the case of Lizzie Banks, and she's still awaiting the final verdict almost 2 years after an adverse analytical finding in an anti-doping test found that same substance, chlorthalidone. Now, she gave that sample in May 2023 and was notified of the test result in late July 2023. And then she put together a very comprehensive defence and presented that case to UKAD, the United Kingdom's anti-doping agency. And they reviewed all of that evidence and issued a no-fault, no-negligence finding with no sanction. That was in April 2024, and you may remember that in June last year, Lizzie was interviewed for the cycling podcast by Tom Carey of The Telegraph, in which she explained in really great detail and depth the specifics of her case. A couple of weeks after that, in early July, she learned that WADA was appealing the verdict that UKAD had delivered, and they didn't want to accept the no-fault, no-negligence, no-sanction result. So they've appealed to the Court of Arbitration for Sport, and Lizzie once again put together a defence, and that hearing was heard by CAS just before Christmas, and the result was due on February the 28th. 2 days before that, Lizzie was informed by the Court of Arbitration for Sport that the deadline had been extended, and so now she'll have to wait until April the 18th to find out what the final result is. That's almost 2 years after the adverse analytical finding in the first place. Now, Michael Hessmann's back in action this week. Obviously, he's a younger athlete, 23 years old, with potentially his career ahead of him. And so he accepted that negotiation and compromise, even though he protested his innocence. He kind of accepted the result, took the suspension, and is back in action. Whereas Lizzie Banks is 34 years old, and she's already announced that she's retiring from cycling. But her whole life has been on hold for these past couple of years. And I think it's a case that we'll look at again in more detail once the Court of Arbitration for Sport has finally delivered its verdict.
We mentioned contamination a few weeks ago, didn't we, in relation to another sport, tennis, and the world number one, Jannik Sinner. We didn't go into a lot of detail, but one issue, I think, Lionel, and well, contamination is going to be an increasingly big issue over the next couple of years in anti-doping. One of the issues, I believe, is that the technology for detecting substances is obviously getting better, and therefore more banned substances. There are going to be more adverse analytical findings and tiny infinitesimal amounts of substances are going to be detected. And for a lot of substances, that's all they need for an adverse analytical finding. And it creates a bit of a tangled web, doesn't it, to say the least?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the rule of strict liability, combined with the increased improvement and sensitivity of the testing equipment and procedures, means that smaller and smaller traces can be detected, can't they? So that, coupled with the real world possibility of contamination from medications and even food, means that there really has to be a conversation about the risks of contamination. I mean, athletes don't seem to be aware. It's not really on the radar. But the issue here is that the national anti-doping agencies that have studied the defences in both these cases have decided in one case, Hessman's, to give a lenient penalty, and in another case, Lizzie Banks's, no penalty at all. The thing is, there's a difference of opinion with WADA not accepting the decisions of the agencies that are charged with responsibility of deciding these cases. So really, the athletes are being put in a very difficult situation.
Shall I go next? We shall be talking about beef. Not contaminated beef, although we have talked about that before in professional cycling many moons ago, you may remember. But old-fashioned beef of the kind we don't often get these days in professional cycling. This is a little bit petty. I feel slightly sort of guilty for even bringing this up, but it did catch a lot of people's eye at the weekend. French rider Alexis Brunel. Larry, any dealings with Alexis Brunel?
No, I mean, just like a few words here or there, but I don't know him very well, no.
Okay. I did not know him very well either. However, he was an unusual signing a couple of years ago, for two or three years ago, for UAE Team Emirates. Unusual in the sense that that team has historically not had many French riders. Why did they sign him? Because he has been touted for many years as a bit of a sort of super talent, a bit of a wunderkind in France. He's 26 years of age now, from Boulogne-sur-Mer. He was, in his youth, the European Junior TT champion. He was the French Junior and also under 23 TT champion. And when he was at UAE, well, it didn't go very well at all. This was after a couple of years at Groupama. At UAE, he didn't finish the season and, in fact, ceased to be a professional cyclist. Halfway through the season, decided it wasn't for him. As I said, that was in 2022. This year, he has decided that he wanted to make a comeback, and he managed to get himself a one-year contract with Total Energie. As I said, supposedly a big talent, and he has proven that already this year, because about 10 days ago, he won the GP Montserrat in Belgium. He's got high hopes. Why are we talking about him this week? Well, he's given a long interview to L'Equipe magazine, and as I said, I wasn't that familiar with him and his character, but he has got a reputation as a bit of a firebrand, a bit of a maverick, maybe as evidenced by what happened in 2022 with UAE. He just sort of downed tools and took himself off to do something else. And this interview talked about his character, talked about how he was a bit of a divisive figure already when he was a pro rider. And in the L'Equipe magazine piece, he underlined that sort of character trait by taking aim at a former teammate, former team leader, I suppose, at Groupama, David Gaudu. I'm just going to read the one quote that did catch a lot of people's eye. "I hate him. He spat all over me on his stupid sort of Twitch broadcast. He's a horrible guy. He thinks he's a champion. He is not. Maybe he won some races, but that doesn't make him a big rider. He's got nothing like Thibaut Pinot. When Thibaut was in my wheel, I gave 1,000%, and I would have sort of rolled over for Thibaut so he could tickle my stomach." And I didn't say that, tickle my stomach. But this was quite a remarkable outburst. And it caused some consternation at Paris-Nice. Obviously, Groupama were there. They were at Tirreno as well. I spoke to some people in the team, and the team were quite aggrieved that they hadn't been offered right of reply on this story. I'm not sure what they would have said, Groupama FDJ formally denies that David Gourdeau is a horrible man. and I also caused some teeth gnashing when I put a request in to the press office for a three-way interview. David Gourdeau, Alexis Brunel and Arnaud Démare. That is not going to happen any point soon on the Cycling Podcast or anywhere else. But this whole beef, this whole saga did make me very curious about Alexis Brunel and what he might get up to over the next few weeks. He's committed, he says, to his sort of second career, second bite at the cherry as a professional cyclist. This piece quoted his agent saying, oh, he might just win a monument this year. I think that's sort of slightly optimistic agent speak, but we shall see. We shall see. Larry, any thoughts on what he might achieve?
I think he's really strong. I think, you know, he was supposed to be, like kind of a big talent before. And apparently he has a really big engine. But what I had heard was that perhaps he wasn't exactly the best in the peloton. He wasn't exactly the best racer, you know? I guess also when he was at UAE, he believed in himself so much that he also didn't necessarily want to work so much for the others is what I had heard, you know? But I think on a team like Total, it's probably a great environment because, you know, you get to go in the breakaway, you get to attack, and it's less like, just riding the front for the others. And I am guessing we'll see more results from him. Maybe not a monument this year, but I think he'll probably do some nice results.
And the other reason to mention Alexis Brunel and his comeback with Total Energy is that that team is in the news this week, or that company, Total Energy, because they have been linked with taking over sponsorship of Ineos Grenadiers. This is reported by Escape Collective. These rumours have been sort of doing the rounds for a few days, certainly last week, and was reported, as I say, by Escape Collective. Seems a strange one. Total Energy, of course, have sponsored that team, Jean-René Bernardeau's team, for quite a while. We found out a little bit more about the sponsorship in the last few days. That is, the sort of French arm of that company sponsors that team. This would be the global entity, Total Energy, that are supposedly in conversations to take over Ineos Grenadiers. I'm not sure if this has been reported, but they were in discussions with another team last year, Bahrain Victorious. They thought they were pretty close to securing some kind of sponsorship agreement with Total Energy, but we shall see. I know that Ineos Grenadiers, well, they're certainly looking. I don't think that's any secret, and they have engaged an agency to help them look for new sponsorship, and Total Energy are one of the companies they have spoken to, are speaking to. I don't know if they're further along with Total Energy than anyone else, but Lionel, have you heard anything?
Not really anything concrete that hasn't been reported already, Daniel. I mean, we know that Ineos's entire sports operation is in a state of uncertainty at the moment, isn't it? Jim Ratcliffe's focus is completely on Manchester United Football Club, it seems. And over the past few months, he's been sort of jettisoning other sports sponsorship deals, scaling back commitments in other sports. So it seemed inevitable for a while that there might be a bit of a realigning of his involvement, Ineos's involvement in the cycling team. Away from the sport, though, there are some close links between Ineos and Total Energies. Ineos has been buying some of Total Energies' assets in the petrochemical industry over the past couple of years, and they work closely together on other assets. I'm not an energy expert, so I don't really know the full ins and outs of that, but there's definitely been some big deals between the two organisations. So it probably makes sense that there might be some collaboration on the cycling front as well. As you say, though, the issue is the existing French Total Energies team. All those riders have contracts, and I think the earlier speculation that something might happen as soon as this year's Tour de France might be a little bit wider than mark, and that the more recent reports that they're looking at something for 2026 seems more likely. But we'll have to see over the coming months.
I don't think that Jean-René Bernardeau needs to sell any of his yachts just yet. I think he can probably wait until the end of the season.
Just very lastly on Alexis Brunel, I mean, it's quite the career path, isn't it? From Groupama FDJ, a short stint at UAE Team Emirates, then racing for a club in Dunkirk for a season, and then a season doing gravel racing. He won a couple of stages of the Oregon Trail Gravel over in the US, and now tipped for monument success very, very soon with Total Energies.
Chute à l'arrière du peloton, Cycling Podcast Team Car at the back of the pack, please.
That's Seb Piquet, the voice of Radio Tour, to remind me to tell you that this episode is sponsored by Saily. Saily is an eSIM brought to you by the creators of NordVPN, and it will ensure that you can stay connected when you're abroad without racking up roaming charges. When you're travelling, whether on holiday or for work, it can be a real drag to have to pay extra fees just to use your phone as you would when you're at home. Let's face it, you want to be able to stay in contact with people or use social media, listen to podcasts or watch streaming services, and these can all drain your data and leave you with additional fees to pay. So how does Saily work? Well, it's very simple. You download the app, which is compatible with Apple iOS or Android devices, and it works on all smartphones that support eSIM technology. Then you buy the plan that suits you. If you're traveling to more than one country, you don't need to install a new eSIM for each one. You just buy a global or regional plan that covers the countries you're visiting. Install and activate your eSIM, and you'll easily connect to a local network as soon as you arrive at your destination. It's affordable too, and will significantly reduce or even eliminate roaming charges. And because it's powered by NordVPN, you know your connections are secure as well. All Cycling Podcast listeners can get a great deal today. Download the Saily app in your app store and use the code CYCLING at checkout to get 15% off your first purchase. Or go to saily.com/cycling. That's saily.com/cycling.
So, Larry, are we going to talk about your holiday or mine first?
We can talk about mine.
Okay, let's go to Italy, shall we? Let's journey back in time and let's cross the Mediterranean, cross a tiny corner of Mediterranean. This was one thing I was thinking about yesterday in the sort of this perennial or eternal battle between Tirreno Adriatico and Pyrenees, which is a better race. How many people actually know? How many sort of casual cycling fans know what Tirreno Adriatico refers to? Pyrenees is slightly more what it says on the tin. I know you know, Larry. You're not a lay cycling fan.
You know, anyway. Though, our team doctor, who is Italian, he asked us, do you know what Tirreno Adriatico means or like is? And I was like, well, yeah. And he's like, you would know. A lot of cyclists, they don't know this. I was like, okay, well...
I believe you.
Is this because they put Tirreno into Google Maps and it doesn't find a town?
Yeah.
It's the race from the two seas, isn't it? The Tirreno is on the west and the Adriatic is on the east, right? So it goes across.
Yes. From west to east, yes. The problem that this race has had in terms of the identity of the race is that the start point in particular has moved a lot over the years up and down the Tyrrhenian Sea. Sometimes it's been as low as Naples. Nowadays, it tends to be up in Tuscany. And that hasn't helped the race to sort of establish an identity. The identity on the other side is a lot clearer. It's always kind of in the Marche that it finishes. But anyway, Lionel, do you want to tell us what happened in Tirreno?
Well, as we've predicted, I mean, we were all over this last week. We predicted that Juan Ayuso would be very difficult to beat, and so it proved. He took the overall victory after winning stage 6, which was the uphill finish to Frottignano. It was his third race victory in a row after the Fondrome Classic in France and the Trofeo Leguelia, and I suppose he was the man of the week. The other man of the week really was Filippo Ganna, who I thought rode extremely well. He took the time trial on the opening day and led until Ayuso won his stage and then fought really, really hard to stay on the podium when perhaps he could have just eased back a bit. And on the final stage, he won a time bonus in an intermediate sprint to leapfrog Antonio Tiberi into second place overall. A very fine week of racing for Ganna. A real statement of intent, I think, ahead of Milan-San Remo. I don't know what you two guys think about that. Perhaps talk about that a bit later. The other stages, well, there were three sprint stages, and the final tally was Jonathan Milan 2 for Lidl Trek and Olav Koy 1 for Visma Lisa Bike. The two most eye-catching stages really were the seven-hour race in the rain, which I'm sure Larry enjoyed. The weather wasn't quite as bad at Tirreno Adriatico as it was at Paris-Nice, but still a pretty rough week. The rain jacket probably got a lot of wear, didn't it, Larry? But Andrea Vendrame of Decathlon AG2R La Mondiale won that, the longest stage of the race. There were some echelons the day Olav Koy won, which is a bit of a rarity in Italian racing. And I think the best ride of the week really came from the Norwegian Frederik Deversnes of UnoX. He was part of the big break and he stayed away on his own by the skin of his teeth, really, just about held on to win ahead of the roaring peloton led by Matthew van der Poel. So an overall victory for Ayuso. And a very good week for Filippo Ganna, which I think puts him on the sort of first page of favourites or potential winners for Milan-San Remo.
I would like to ask Larry in a second whether he knows where he finished. First, just while, before I forget, David Gourdou, who we mentioned earlier, he crashed out on the neutralised, in the neutralised zone.
In the feed zone.
On the day after Alexis Brunel's now notorious, now infamous outburst. So a very bad day for David Gourdou. Larry, 68th place on general classification. That's not really what you were there for. But no. How did it go?
I would say for the team, it was a pretty relatively successful week. We had, I think, 2 second places, a fourth place, and then a seventh place on the stage. So, you know, I think, on the opening day, our sprinter, Michael Szilard, he did a really, good last few hundred meters and ended up, second to Jonathan Milan, which I think was about as best as we could have done on that day. Milan was like another level, so that was a pretty respectable result. And then I think we saw our teammate Rick Ploymers, who he won in Muscat in Oman, and I think he really showed that he has like a really good level, so that was pretty cool, because he was second and fourth, and I think he was second to Olav Koy the day of the crosswinds. And you never know, but in the end, Koy wasn't in the group. We were in the front group, and I would imagine Koy wouldn't have come back if Mikel Landa didn't get a flat, because once Landa got a flat, then Quickstep started to ride full to bring it back from behind. So then the group that Koy was in came back to our group after having been distanced pretty much the whole day, and then it made a lot bigger group for the sprint. So I think he would have had a really good shot at the win. Had Landa not flatted that day, but it was I would say we were pretty satisfied on the whole. We were going to try, originally Michael Storer was going to do Tirreno with us, and he was going to be there for GC, and then they put him in Paris-Nice the last minute, so they asked Mark Hirschi to do the GC, but in the end I think he prefers one day races, so he's not really a big fan of doing GC, and unfortunately it didn't work out on the mountain day, but it was a nice week, and I think for us in general it was a pretty good race.
Were you, Larry, in your now customary road captain role?
No, I wasn't really the road captain, but not designated road captain, but I was there to help and, share my experience. And, I think it's also like everyone has to sort of get comfortable with me before I sort of start doing that role. I think on the road I was able to help the guys quite a lot and put them in really good position in all the critical moments. So that was cool, except for the really long rainy day. I had a very, very bad day.
I wasn't that familiar with the Tirreno route. because as you know, I was otherwise engaged at Paris-Nice. And on the day when that stage happened, I opened popular cycling results website and saw 240 kilometers and I couldn't quite believe it. I mean, this
plus
is
like
not
a 7K
unusual
neutral, I think, you know.
Yeah, this is not unusual for RCS, but I thought that over the last few years they had slowly phased out those 240 kilometer stages. I knew there was still 210, occasionally 220, but 240 in Tirreno surprised me.
But Larry, does that? I mean, isn't the thinking here that it's a kind of a dry run, no pun intended, for Milan San Remo, which obviously is pushing 300 still, even with the route change? Is that something that helps? Does it help the riders to do a big 6.5-7 hour day, what, 10 days before Milan San Remo? Or is it, you know, it's not going to, you know, make or break a successful ride a week later?
I mean, I think it was a nice excuse for a long transfer, you know? Like, I think in the end they just wanted us to do the transfer on the bike and not on the road, you know? But you know, had it been like good weather, it would have been totally fine and it wouldn't have been anything to write home about. But
who says the Giro d'Italia and RCS never do anything for the environment?
Yeah, I don't know.
The most carbon neutral stage of all time.
But yeah, you know, I don't know. We had 45 minutes in the dry, almost dry sprinkles, and then it just started pouring. And yeah, so in the end, I think it took us something like 6 hours, 45 minutes or I don't know, but you know, so it was actually even longer than San Remo in terms of time, which was just ridiculous. But yeah, you know, I mean, the problem was it was such a terrible day, you know, and then you get on the bus and then you see in Paris it was like snowing or something. And then you're like, oh, now we can't even complain because, you know, they even had it worse. So yeah. And then the day after we had a lot of rain, and then we got pretty lucky after that. So I have to say, on the whole, we were pretty lucky compared to the guys in Paris-Nice. But still, that was a pretty brutal day.
Just with the temperature and the bad weather, which was a theme of the week. But it's kind of, you know, I was going back today looking through the archives of Paris-Nice just to check that it has always been this much of a talking point at Paris-Nice. And it has. Sort of, sure enough, you go back through the archives and maybe 3-4 times a decade, you find editions when stages have been cancelled or shortened, severely shortened. And you mentioned that 240-kilometer stage in Tirreno. I found one in Paris-Nice earlier, I think it was in the 1950s, when it was shortened. The organisers took mercy on the riders because there was snow throughout the course, basically. But it was shortened to 250 kilometres, Larry. you know, this is not new. It's not new in Paris-Nice. It's not new in Tirreno. One thing, maybe we'll come on to this later, but one thing that has changed in Paris-Nice particularly is that the race goes to higher climbs. Sort of 1,000 metre plus climbs, certainly summit finishes, is kind of new in Paris-Nice. It's sort of a development of the last 10 years. However, bad weather in March, not new. What does change and evolve, Larry, is equipment and clothing. Now, my cameraman on Paris-Nice, he's not, by his own admission, he would say that he's not a cycling specialist. And he was asking me about the clothing. And I said to him, well, if they didn't care about going fast, there are ways to stay warm. You could wear sort of real kind of Eskimo gear, and you could wear like Gore-Tex trousers. But it is about, obviously it's about threading the needle, finding the right compromise between performance and warmth and staying dry. However, part of me can't quite believe, and we haven't got a clothing sponsor and we're probably never going to get one again after this, but part of me can't quite believe that in 2025 there isn't better completely waterproof clothing and breathable clothing.
Yeah, I mean, it's tough. Actually, Gianluca Brambilla was in the peloton wearing a hood on that 240k day, and a lot of us questioned the aerodynamics of that. But yeah, you know, I mean, maybe he was warm. I wasn't. So, you know, that's the thing. I think the hard thing with high-tech rain gear is, since we're exercising, you also need it to be breathable. And, you know, I guess if you, you know, ride a motorcycle and you have, you know, these crazy jackets, I don't think those are like breathable because you're not sweating, you know, you're not like exercising inside them. So I think that's probably like the hardest number one is to make something that's super waterproof and super breathable. And then, you know, the thing is there's always going to be places where the water is going to get in, you know, in the neck, you know, I mean, yeah, I guess with the shorts, they, you know, you can't just put on like rain pants, you know, like it's just, yeah, it doesn't work because it probably gets stuck in the chain or something. So, you know, we still have to work in the sort of like dimensions of pro cycling. And yeah, it's, I would have thought
nudity might work better than
sometimes it's possible. I did take my gloves off.
If you think about it, Lionel,
it actually felt warmer, but
it probably would work because the problem is the liquid, the cold rain being trapped against your body, isn't it?
Yeah.
Generally speaking.
Yeah. So, I mean, yeah. And then, you know, now the thing is that we think so much about aerodynamics and we go so fast that that's also something we're thinking about. Like, you know, I don't want to wear this really baggy rain jacket because we're going however fast. And yeah, I have a friend on another team. They did like aero testing on their rain jackets and the rain jacket was like 50 watts slower. So at like race speed. So that's a really big amount to give up, you know? So yeah, you know, I mean, it's just something, you know, we have all this stuff going on in our heads. And then, yeah, I guess for me, for example, on the 240K day, I had brought like all the clothes on me because I didn't want to have to, essentially on these days, there are some times where you want to go back to the car and so many people want to go back to the car at the same time. It's really hard to go back to the car to get changed, whatever. So I was like, okay, I'm going to bring everything with me. So I had like, you know, I mean, in my entire wardrobe, in my pockets. And but then the problem was I never went back to the car to get dry stuff and I got really, really, really cold. And, you know, a lot of my teammates, they changed a couple times. And so the next day, again, we went quite high and then we descended on a really long descent, which happens to also be a road that was probably in the Giro once one of the coldest I've ever been in my life because I didn't have a rain jacket. And anyway, same descent, freezing again. And I had dressed fine. But then one of my teammates decided to stop and change all his clothes. And I was like, okay, you know what? I better do this too. Stopped, changed all the clothes. You know, your hands are so cold, like you don't have any dexterity anymore. So you can't really like even do the zipper. So like essentially like the director and mechanic are changing you, you know? And I'm just directing where the things are in my rain bag. And then, so I changed essentially my rain jacket, my GABA thing, the gloves, had another pair of gloves. And then it was just crazy because once I put on dry stuff and then it wasn't raining as much after. So that helped. But I mean, I felt like a new person and then I was totally fine. But in this section of road where I changed, I was then coming back through the cars. I'd say there were at least 60 to 80 guys stopped on the side of the road changing all their clothes. Like that's how cold it was, you know, which is pretty crazy.
We should interject at this point. You're very fortunate because you've got an excellent clothing sponsor.
Yes, ASOS. Yeah, exactly. We are lucky. Yeah.
Both stylish and waterproof and breathable.
Yeah, exactly.
But... well, maybe we should move on from this topic before we get ourselves in any more trouble. But,
sorry.
Larry, other talking points in Lionel as well. Other talking points from Tirreno. We've talked about Juan Ayuso's dog. We should probably talk about Juan Ayuso's riding, and also Filippo Ganna was, I suppose, one of the more eye-catching performers.
And I have to say, I think his team rode super well. I mean, you know, okay, so they were controlling for him, but, you know, even guys like Kwiatkowski fully selling out, you know, like you don't always see guys who are like capable of winning races fully selling out for the team. And, you know, I think that's pretty cool. You know, just the way they rode, you know, even just to like go for that sprint, that took a lot of, you know, I mean, they had to invest a lot to go for a few seconds. And okay, maybe he did get a little lead out from Milan at the end, but his team did a really good job. And I have to say they were pretty impressive this whole week. So chapeau to them and him.
Yeah, I thought, you know, statement of intent so far this season from Ineos Grenadiers. I mean, what was on the line there was finishing second rather than third. And they you know, could perfectly easily just have thought, no, we won't bother going for that. We don't need to do that. But because it was possible to leapfrog with a few seconds. But like you say, the investment into that was significant. I do wonder whether Philippe Ogana has overshown his card there with Milan San Remo coming up, especially when contrasted with Matthew van der Poel, who kind of had a much lower key week, but did look reasonably good in, you know, two or three occasions, didn't he? Kind of testing his legs a bit. I always think back to the Sean Kelly year when he won Milan San Remo towards the end of his career, 1992, and Moreno Argentine was just absolutely, you know, head and shoulders above everybody at Tirreno Adriatico, and Sean Kelly felt that he overshowed his strength, and maybe a little bit wiser just to keep under the radar, because everyone will be watching Ganna now, won't they? And I mean, he's got all of the attributes for the, if, you know, surviving the climbs. He's got all the attributes. He'll have a strong team. You know, he could take a flyer. I mean, it's pretty obvious anyway what he would try to do if he was in position to go for the win. What do you think, Larry?
Yeah, I was going to say, I mean, well, I mean, I agree. He looked super strong. I don't think it matters that he showed how strong he was, almost just because, I mean, Pogacar is the number one favorite and everyone's going to watch Pogacar. And like, I don't think it'll change much for Ganna, other than I almost think it could even help him, because when people see him going so well, people are going to give him more space in the bunch. You know, if he wants to go in somewhere, I think they're going to, yeah, maybe be like, oh, this is a good wheel to follow. So I don't really think it's going to hurt him. Maybe if there wasn't such a crazy favorite like Pogacar that everyone's going to be watching, then maybe more so. But I don't think he hurt himself in any regard there. And I do think he is going to be, yeah, he's a big favorite for the podium for sure.
Larry, just in terms of the economy of the effort in Tirreno, I've heard riders, well, they've said this in relation to Paris-Nice as well in the past. I remember talking to Sam Bennett a couple of years ago about if you are going really, really well at the start of one of those two races, but your goal is Milan-San Remo, your main goal is Milan-San Remo, the difficulty of balancing workload with staying fresh and when to force it, when to pull back. Obviously, Tirreno, the dates of Tirreno in relation to Milan-San Remo has changed slightly. It now finishes on the weekend, whereas once upon a time it finished on the Tuesday. So that maybe changes things slightly. But will, I mean, Van der Poel, for example, Lionel, you mentioned him. His goal for the week in Tirreno was to have three big efforts, three big hitouts on three specific days, and he supposedly did that and was happy with that. But do riders still, those riders who are targeting victory in Milan-San Remo, not saying you're not, Larry, but will they have that at the forefront of their mind, that there is a point at which, you know, you're going over a red line and it's, and it might compromise San Remo still in a week's time or over a week's time?
I think if you have the legs to win San Remo, there's nothing you can do to hurt yourself in Tirreno, pretty much. You know, like, I think if you're so strong, unless you're maybe just like a pure sprinter, you know, like, I don't know, maybe Jasper Philipsen or something, maybe he could overdo it in a race like Tirreno. But I would say for these guys who are like climbery types, I think if they are, you know, just pushing it in the bunch and, you know, trying to follow or go hard on the final climb, things like that, I don't think there's any harm to be done. But I guess it also depends what you did before the race. And I would say if you are aiming for San Remo, you know, you probably didn't come into Tirreno too fatigued, because otherwise then, yeah, maybe you could do some damage. But yeah, I think, you know, there's plenty of time to recover between. It's not like it's 2 days later or something. So 5 days is plenty of time. And I honestly just think it's great preparation for the race. You know, doing a week-long stage race, I think you come out with like just, you know, either Paris-Nice or Tirreno, you come out with just super good form, because it's hard to get those kind of efforts in training. Riding at super high speeds, all the little accelerations in the bunch, sprinting out of corners, punching over the top of climbs, things like that. So yeah.
Do you know your Ninka Vinkas from your Amber Cracks? No? Well, then we will have a podcast for you. Yes, it's Rose Manley from the Cycling Podcast Feminine here, and we need your help. If you're a men's cycling fan and want to follow the women's scene but don't know where to start, then we are putting together a special Introduction to the Women's Peloton podcast. And we want questions and queries from newbie or wannabe fans. It could be things like, what's the biggest rivalry? Or are there three Grand Tours? Or which team is everyone most scared of? All questions welcome, none too stupid or too basic. Record them on a voice memo and email them to contact@thecyclingpodcast.com, and we'll hope to answer some of them in our special show.
That was Rose Manley, host of the Cycling Podcast Femina. The latest episode is out now, featuring Rose, Denny Gray and Rebecca Charlton. And that features a little segment about the old Primavera Rosa race, which ran from 1999 to 2005, the women's version of Milan-San Remo. It's held on the same course. And Milan-San Remo for women is back this weekend, eagerly awaited, and Rose will be back with an episode of Arrivé talking about the first big one-day race of the season, the first monument, I guess, and Daniel and I will recap Milan-San Remo, the men's race as well. So listen out to Arrivé at the weekend, Saturday, to be precise.
So Larry, we've talked about your holiday in Italy, your week away in Italy. Now to talk about mine in France, just over the border, over the other side of the Alps. Miserable week. I don't know which was more miserable, Tirreno or Paris-Nice. It's going to be 2050. All the Earth's rivers and seas will have dried up. Average temperatures are going to be 50 degrees in January, February, March, April, and so on and so forth throughout the year, and it's still going to be 4 degrees and drizzling in Les Yvelines at the start of Paris-Nice. Absolutely unbelievable. The forecast wasn't that bad, but it turned out to be pretty grim. Lionel, do you want to tell us just who won the stages and who won GC?
Yeah, well, as you say, Daniel, horrendous weather all week. A little bit of a glimpse of the sun right at the very end for you. It impacted on the racing as well, didn't it? Because stage four was neutralised for 20K. Stage seven on Saturday was shortened significantly. But it didn't stand in the way of Matteo Jorgensen winning Paris-Nice for the second year in a row. And he based a very solid week-long performance around Visma Lisa Bike's win in the team time trial, which went from the motor racing circuit at Manicourt to Nevers. Less good news for Visma Lisa Bike, though. Jonas Vingegaard crashed going uphill. Bit of a freak crash, wasn't it, on stage five. He was in the leader's jersey at the time, having taken it the previous day when João Almeida won the stage, and that meant that the Danish rider, one of the two outstanding favourites for the Tour de France later this summer, didn't start stage six. Last week, we'd already recapped Tim Melier winning the two opening sprint stages for Sudal Quickstep. The other highlights of the week, really, Lenny Martinez for Bahrain victorious, taking a step towards potentially being a big French star at the Tour de France. That's the plan anyway. A very well-timed attack on the final climb, stage five. That was the day that Vingegaard crashed. But when Jorgensen rode very strongly, but seemed to be taken a little bit by surprise, but his eye really was on the overall race. And then the final three stages, equally impressive victories, really, for Mads Pedersen, Michael Storer of your team, Tudor, Larry, and Magnus Sheffield of Ineos Grenadiers on the final stage. The overall, then, victory for Jorgensen. Less good news for Matthias Skelmoser, who crashed on the penultimate stage while lying third overall. So it meant that Jorgensen won 37 seconds ahead of Florian Lipovits of Red Bull, with Timon Arensman of Ineos third. We didn't really mention the sort of high-profile abandons from Tirreno Adriatico, but one thing that both races had in common was a lot of star riders not finishing the race. Vingegaard, as I've mentioned, but Brandon McNulty, Skelmoser, Santiago Buitrago, Kasper Asgreen, and a lot of the sprinters who pulled out before the final hilly stage. But yeah, quite attritional, both races, weren't they? What were your highlights, though, Daniel?
Well, Lionel, I noticed you didn't point out that I had predicted Matteo Jorgensen's victory in the podcast 2 weeks ago. I'm very proud of myself for that. That wasn't difficult, was it, to be honest? Although I suppose Vingegaard would have been most people's favourite. I've got a few notes here, chaps. I've condensed Paranese into a list of notes. For Jorgensen, I've got Jorgensen's joie de vivre. Larry, one thing that strikes me about Matteo Jorgensen, when I interview him and when I speak to him, and obviously at Paris because he was in the jersey most days, and so he was coming behind the podium most days, we have a nice little chit-chat. He's a gentleman, a young man, who loves his job. And that is not always communicated by all riders in all interviews. But Matteo seems to me, and particularly since he's joined Visma Leasebike, is in the perfect place for him. And he's exactly where he wants to be in his career. And it's nice to get that sense from a rider that they are enjoying themselves. Because, as I say, it's not that common.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think he's always enjoying himself. I think sometimes measuring the food and sitting on top of a mountain, things like that can be hard. But yeah, I think he does enjoy it. And I think he
loves the process.
He does like the process. And I think he really appreciates being on a team like Visma because he just has to ride his bike, you know, and they take care of everything else. Whereas before, you know, I think he really felt like he had to do everything himself, arrange altitude camps, things like that. And he was questioning everything before, and now he has so much trust in their system that all he does is essentially do what they say and then pedal. And it seems to work pretty well. So yeah, I think he really likes that.
A lot of deserved acclaim for his victory today. I saw a clip with Bradley Wiggins predicting that he was a future Tour de France winner. Matteo Jorgensen, 25, of course. Slightly reminiscent of, in 1989, Miguel Indurain won Paris-Nice and Pedro Delgado declared that he will be a future Tour de France champion. And that prophecy was justified. Well, that was vindicated, wasn't it? Because Miguel Indurain went on to win 5 tours. Jorgensen, I think, chaps, it really depends on how cycling and how the tour evolves over the next few years. It depends what direction ASO go in terms of time trials, not time trials. I can see Jorgensen becoming quite a dominant time trialist, but the racing has become so explosive over the last few years that we haven't seen so many riders of Jorgensen's ilk do really well in the tour.
I think the other thing is the time trials that there are now always have like giant hills in them also. So then, you know, it still favors Vingegaard or Pogacar more than Matteo. But yeah, bring back the 55k flat time trials in the tour.
The 90k.
I'm about 90. But when I was a kid, there were like 50 something k time trials.
In the 80s, then in the 80s, before I was watching cycling, there was a 90. Was it in 1987?
I think in Futuroscope, 87k. I think it might have been, wow. But yeah, very very long individual time trial. It must have been over
that
2 hours.
That makes my back just hurt thinking about it.
Just on Jorgensen and kind of like the weight of history. I mean, I looked at his date of birth. Daniel, you said he was 25. He was born on July the 1st. Shares a birthday with me. Oh. I mean, amazing.
Wow. And my sister.
Both born in 1999. Amazing. Well, two titans of the cycling world born on the same day in 1999.
He was born 2 days before Lance Armstrong won the prologue in Le Puy de Fou, I think it was, in 1999, wasn't it? And took the yellow jersey for the first time in his career. So,
You can tell that you went on the podcast for a few months. You're not giving him his proper name, the controversial Lance Armstrong in these parts. And just thinking about Jorgensen and the Tour de France, one other thing that occurred to me is that we've become unaccustomed to that career trajectory that was very familiar of Tour champions to sort of reach their peak at 26, 27, which is actually when the controversial Lance Armstrong, in inverted commas, won his first Tour de France, but also Indurain. And that was around the age around which people did win their first tours. But in the last few years, it has been quite different, hasn't it? With Bernal and then Pogacar and even Vingegaard was a lot younger than that. So, chaps, that was the top of my list. Second bullet point was a provocative one. Pedersen, better than Van Aert? Just leave that.
I mean,
he was insane. Yes. Larry, his chances in Milan-San Remo got to be Well, they have been pretty good. Better than Jonathan Milan, his teammate, I would say. But of course, as we know, Mads Pedersen doesn't really care much for Milan Sanremo. Does that matter? I don't know. He could, based on what we saw certainly yesterday and over the weekend, I don't think he will fear, maybe he will fear a Pogacar sort of nuclear attack on the Poggio, but certainly anything that Ganna will be able to do, maybe even anything Van der Poel will be able to do. I think Pedersen...
I think Pogacar is the only guy dropping him on those climbs based on the way he's gone.
Next bullet point. Lipovic, Red Bull's future? Question mark. Will Red Bull pivot from Roglic to Lipovic after this year? Certainly looks very solid at the moment. A very robust rider. And I think anyone who finished high up on general classification in Paris-Nice had to be, by definition, very robust given the weather that we faced last week. Red Bull, interesting team this year, chaps. Was having a few conversations at Paris-Nice just about all of the changes behind the scenes there. They're trying to do a lot of different things, new things, change. Well, they're certainly changing their whole approach to nutrition or their whole sort of nutrition department. And it has involved a lot of work, I think, for all concerned. And there might be some teething problems as far as that's concerned this year. But they're certainly shaping up where they're looking beyond this year, and their sights are firmly set on the race of top of the sport, the position that UAE currently hold. Another team who had an excellent week, Ineos, going dambusters. Ineos's pivot to this very aggressive racing style, it's really working, isn't it, chaps? You can't deny it. It helps that they have got a lot of riders in really good form and a lot of fit riders, not too many riders. I mean, they have got a couple who have crashed out, but they've got fit riders who are confident as well. A few who seem to have regained confidence. Tobias Foss, for example, seems to be rejuvenated. I'm really keen to see how he goes. He was telling me on Saturday he's targeting the classics really for the first time, and part of his approach to the classics has been a much looser approach to nutrition, in a similar vein, not quite as extreme maybe, to his countryman Jonas Abrahamsson, whose new approach, slightly looser approach to nutrition, got a lot of attention at last year's Tour de France. But Foss of the classics, going to be interesting. And another sort of tick or another kind of upvote for aggressive racing, Astana were also very good in Paris-Nice, and their approach is different in the sense that they're trying to hoard points, but they're going into every race day with a distinct sort of a real focus, and that is helping as well. Not this sort of loosey-goosey pourquoi pas, we'll try and get in the break. They know exactly what they're doing every day and it's working, a bit like Ineos. Next point on my list, chaps, Vingegaard. Should we be worried? Question mark. I'm just going to throw this out there and see what you both think. Obviously, he crashed out. Obviously, it was an unfortunate incident. He hit his lip. He hit his hand. No one's questioning that. Well, he could have carried on. There was no doubt, really, that he was going to pull out. However, he said one thing to me earlier in the week. He said that, riders aren't showing each other enough respect in the peloton, and this was making racing too dangerous. And B, maybe more interestingly, he said he was not going for gaps that he used to go for, and he was not being as aggressive in the peloton as he used to be because he is slightly anxious in the peloton. Should we be worried about that, chaps, looking ahead? On his behalf.
I mean, I don't think so. I mean, the thing is, he has such a good team looking after him. And being who he is, everyone's going to give him the gap almost. So I don't think it's going to be an issue. Maybe if he was trying to race like Flanders or Paris-Roubaix, yes. But I think in Grand Tour racing, it won't be a huge issue. Yes, there's like the first week of the tour.
Yeah, think about that first week, Larry.
Yeah,
in the north of France.
Surely, but, you know, his team's going to really watch out for him, and I think he'll be fine. And then after a week, everyone gets tired and everyone gives a lot more space, and it's not so hard to fight anymore. So I think it'll be okay. I'm not too worried about him.
He's only 28. I think the youngest recorded rider to ever say that there's no respect in the peloton anymore. I mean, there's a sort of tipping point. Yeah, anyone under 27 can't say that, but then it becomes basically a cliche for anyone sort of 29, 30. I think you're allowed to start saying that. But no, it was, I mean, he obviously was looking pretty good. Maybe not quite as good as his teammate, Jorgensen, but you know, safety first, really. I mean, once he'd crashed and you know, cut his lip, and as you say, one or two other bumps and scrapes, perfectly sensible to, you know, call it quits. I mean, it wasn't like the weather was in his favour either. But he'll probably want to get a decent week under his belt at Catalunya later this month. Starts next week, doesn't it? That's his next scheduled appointment. And
the other thing, Lionel, is you mentioned the number of riders, big riders, who crashed out of Paris-Nice, and mainly Paris-Nice, wasn't it? A couple out of Tirreno. But you look how so sparing Vingegaard's program is leading up to the tour. And sort of contrary to what you said, Larry, about stage race giving you great condition before big objectives, all we've heard over the last couple of years, particularly from Visma Lisebike, is that they can simulate race efforts in training. It sort of did make you wonder, Paris-Nice, given how horrible the conditions were, you know, what were guys whose main goal of the season is the Tour de France, what were they there for? And could they in future dispense with races like this and, okay, show up at the Dauphiné, but not really race before that?
I mean, I think if it was really, really ideal, they wouldn't. Like, if it was the best thing for the Tour de France to never race, they just wouldn't race and they just show up at the Tour de France. So obviously racing does help some things, you know? I mean, I think racing too much hurts you, right? But I think there's a nice fine balance of, you know, racing, recovering, training, you know? And I think, yeah, we're going way more towards, like, training to race, you know? And that, I think, is the best. But I do think these races can bring you up a level. You know, I mean, yeah, I don't know. There's just certain little things that you're not getting in training. Yes, you probably could try to simulate them doing 75 sprints out of corners in your training in addition to all this other stuff. But, you know, I think there's also this mental fatigue and the mental stress of being in a race that you also need to adapt to. And I think not doing that, you're going to lose a lot of practice, you know? So I think at least we need to do some races before the big objectives.
That's probably reassuring.
Probably the most concerning thing for him, other than the crash, was that, you know, he didn't look absolutely spectacular on the uphill finish that Almeida did he? I mean, you know, he got beaten, having kind of gone on the front foot and put Jorgensen out of the back, and you know, took the jersey from him. So yeah, it certainly wasn't the perfect week, but it's still a long way to go until the Tour de France. But I mean, I made the quip last week that Pogacar could, you know, get a bit of a morale boost from riding the couch to cafe stage race that he's probably done this past week, and just avoid all of the stress and the bad weather and the uncertainty and the little bit of doubt that will have crept in as a result of things not going very well for Vingegaard. And that, you know, that will spread through the team. But I mean, you know, let's face it, Jorgensen had a very good week. It's not, you know, there's really no reason to panic just yet.
And last very quick bullet points. I thought the stage to La Côte Saint-André was a big success. That was a stage the like of which we haven't really seen in Paris before. It was more like a Tirreno Adriatico stage. It was a sort of series of walls, kind of muri, as they call them in Italian, in the last 50 kilometers, and that was really spectacular. Won by Lenny Martinez, which brings me to my next point. Lenny Martinez, he's a young, physically diminutive fella who is under a lot of pressure, and that was underlined by Roman Kreuziger sort of upbraiding him in public the day after he'd won his stage for missing the echelon. I do believe that Roman Kreuziger then privately apologized to Lenny Martinez for saying in the press that he messed it all up for the whole team. But yeah, I got the sense all week really that that team, Bahrain Victorious, they've got big, big ambitions for Lenny Martinez, but left. They need to give him time to grow and develop and to acquire some of those skills that he will need. Next, a missed opportunity for Joao Almeida. Okay, won a stage, but I feel as though he's sort of one side of almost a cold war with Juan Ayuso for status, for a kind of secondary leadership position at UAE, and certainly Ayuso is faring better at the moment. Almeida, this sounds very harsh, but it feels like he let victory through his grasp in the Algarve, and he did to a certain extent at Paris-Nice as well, or he suddenly slipped down the rankings at Paris-Nice. And finally, Larry, question marks over Alaphilippe. I thought that the stage to La Côte-Saint-André, that would be the perfect sort of truth serum. Is Julien Alaphilippe the Julien Alaphilippe of old? Because 4 years ago, he would have won a stage like that, no question. And he finished about 11th, I think. He was good, but not great.
His performance gave me confidence in him because he was like sick quite a bit this offseason. So like, okay, he missed like a lot of training due to sickness. So I actually have to say, I thought he did a pretty damn good job.
Okay, I'm going to correct that. I'm going to redact that. Alaphilippe back and better than ever.
Yeah.
Right, should we talk about Milan Samarin?
Also, give him a nod for the teamwork he did for Michael Storer a couple of days later as well, getting in the break and, you know, laying it all down and helping to set up Storer for that win. I thought that was a really interesting stage as well. They obviously took out the climbs, didn't they? It was just a kind of gradual ramp, really, for what? 70, 80 kilometers, was it? Sort of dragging up to the finish. A real kind of, it was kind of the profile kind of matched the attritional nature of the weather, I thought, just a sort of gradual grinding down. And perhaps no surprise that the break made it, because awful roads to chase on, I'd imagine.
And that just about wraps up Paris-Nice. We're going to spend a few minutes talking about Milan San Remo, but before we do, as a prelude to that, we're going to have this week's Corvitz Corner. Legendary Belgian journalist, unfortunately now retired Belgian journalist, kind of semi-retired, we're bringing him back, Hugo Corvitz of Het Nieuwsblad. He is giving us his insights on the classics every week, and we are calling it Corvitz Corner. It doesn't have a jingle yet, it needs one. Anyway, here's Hugo Corvitz in Corvitz Corner.
Pay attention, freebie. In Flanders, it's now the calm before the storm. On the Oude Quaremont, the mega-large tents are being set to receive thousands and thousands of VIPs for the Ronde van Vlaanderen. They've been working on this for a while, but now they are in a hurry because the Holy Weeks are approaching. What do we have this week in Flanders? On Wednesday, there is Danelignokere Koerse, and on Friday, the Bredene Coxe de Classic for those who have not been selected for Milano Sanremo. Nokere was the last Flemish spring race where every spectator had to pay to see the finish live. To celebrate the 80th birthday, everyone can enter for free. But it's a birthday without the Merlier, who lives 5K from the finish. He's a great absentee. The European champion prefers to rest after a Paris-Nice that was an assault on the body with the cold snow and rain. Merlier has won there 3 times in a row in recent years, but for safety reasons, the organization of Nokere choose to no longer arrive on the iconic cobblestone slope. And Merlier is not amused by that. The last K is now 4% uphill on Macadam. That plays into the hands of Jasper Philipsen, yes, the winner of Milano Sanremo 2024. After Nokere, he travels to Italy. He's one of the few Belgian favorites in the Primavera on Saturday. Without Wout van Aert, Tim Merlier, Arnaud Demare, Maxime Van Gils, and the recovering Remco Evenepoel, only the two Jaspers remain, Philipsen and Stuyven. It makes the experience for the Belgians different than it used to be. I come from a time when Eddy Merckx almost always won the St. Joseph Classic. And if he didn't, Roger de Vlaeminck did it. Milano Sanremo was always held on March 19. After school, I walked home to watch in front of the black and white TV how Merckx almost always outran everyone in the descent of the Poggio. He won up to 7 times. He was already over 60 when I once rode down the Poggio with him. Me in the car, Eddie on the bike that slalomed between the cars. He had crossed the finish line on the Via Roma before I had, in my Fiat. That day, I understood very well why he won La Classicissima up to 7 times. Those times will never come back, unless Tadej Pogačar races until he's 40.
What an image, Lionel. Hugo following Eddie Merckx down the Poggio in his Fiat 500, in his Cinquecento. Wonderful. Wonderful. Milan San Remo. Larry, first of all, are you riding?
No, not currently. I'm not planned. But, you know, you never know what happens these days.
Available for selection.
I mean, preferably I'm not riding, but because I heard it's also supposed to rain, but you never know. But no, I don't think I'm doing it. So.
What's the team's plan?
To be honest, I don't really know, but I guess it'll be Alaphilippe and perhaps Pleumers for the sprint. You know, I think he's been going really well and he can climb pretty well.
I know nothing about your teammate, Rick Pleumers.
Rick.
Give me three facts about Rick Pleumers. I don't think he's ever been at a race that I've covered.
Okay. He has pretty good hair. Sorry?
Colour hair?
Colour? Brown.
Okay,
hair.
that's two facts already. We need one more.
His sister is also a pro cyclist on AG Soudal team. And yeah, okay, I don't know a third.
Okay.
Nice guy.
Okay, good. He's a nice guy. That was about five. So, chaps, what's going to happen in Milan San Remo? Tell me.
I think UAE is going to go full on the Cipressa.
What is it? It's the 5-minute Cipressa, isn't it? This is the holy grail that they've been talking about.
No, it was 9 minutes.
9 minutes, sorry. It's the 9 minutes.
5 minutes would be like driving.
Hugo's free at 500 would struggle with that.
I think. Yeah. I think Tadej needs to attack on the Cipressa to cause chaos. And then hopefully for him, guys will try to follow him. It'll explode. They'll be super disorganized behind. And then he'll go into the Poggio with a gap and no one will catch him. We'll see what happens. But that's what I would do if I were UAE.
Lionel, what would you do?
It does seem that his best hope is that sort of longer range. Because if he waits for the Poggio again, there'll be enough people. If it's a big group, there'll be enough people to just close the door, won't there? We've seen it in the past. And it's hard for him, despite being the best rider in the world, it is hard for him to make the gap and get away on his own. Unless he goes from further out, I think. And the difficulty is that I think Milan San Remo always kind of falls in the favour of, even if the team doesn't win, it's the dynamic of a team that has both a potential attacker and a sprinter, which sort of just shapes how the race goes in that crucial period from the Cipressa to the Poggio. Because on the Cipressa, they kind of want to all keep it together still, don't they? Because it's still a long way to go. And anything that goes from that point is going to ramp up the pressure on the Poggio. And then if it's a big group coming into the bottom of the Poggio, the sprinters have got a real chance because, you know, they can get to the top, even if they're, you know, quite a long way down. There is time to come back if it doesn't split on the descent. So you look at Alpecin De Koninck, they've got the defending champion, Jasper Philipsen, Matthew van der Poel. I mean, basically, they've got the last two winners who've won it in those two distinct ways. Philipsen in the sprint, van der Poel with an attack, and that daredevil descent on the Poggio. Philipsen hasn't raced since winning Koerner Brussels Koerner, so that's the kind of the canary in the mine for the theory that you do or don't need to race a hard week before Milan-San Remo. The other team that I think fits that similar profile, I guess, is Lidl Trek, because they've got Jonathan Milan, who's one of the bigger sprinters. He needs it to kind of all stay together and not be too aggressive, because I get the feeling he would be a sprinter who would slip back more on the, certainly on the Poggio. But then they've got Mads Pedersen, who, as we've already said, is bang in form. And then it's kind of the riders who will play their, you know, perhaps one or two cards, the likes of Filippo Ganna, who, you know, could go for a flyer and do a sort of Cancellara type effort, or a Pozzato, if you remember that far back, effort in the final kilometre. I think, you know, with the big difficulty here is we don't know how it's going to pan out. We're still a fair way from the race. You know, the weather forecast will have something to say about how the race plays out as well. And one of the best things about Milan-San Remo is not knowing which way it will go, and then watching that, as you've described it, Daniel, the best, what is it, the best half hour of the season, really, from the start of the Cipressa to the finish in San Remo. It's one of those sort of periods of racing where it's kind of all happening, even if it looks like nothing is happening. And I think that's what kind of makes it so captivating to watch. We just, you know, don't know what's going to happen, but there's a lot of theories, and we could name any kind of rider, and it sort of all makes sense when you then look at the results at the end and go, oh, it was so obvious that that's how it was going to play out.
There's a lot of speculation for you there, Lionel.
Oh, well, you upbraided me a few weeks ago for refusing to speculate on Strada Bianca.
Does the weather forecast count as speculation? It should really be called the weather speculation, shouldn't it? Not the weather forecast. Let's have some weather speculation. It looks very favourable to Tadej Pogacar. Very favourable indeed, because cold, wet-ish, not that cold actually, 14 degrees, but wet and crucially tailwind. I'm in the UK today, so I've got this in miles per hour, 11 miles per hour. That's quite a tasty wind. If it's a tailwind, that could be significant, Larry, could it not?
Yeah, for sure. And I think also the rain, it'll make the race harder. And the other thing that could affect is, the other thing I might do if I were UAE is go hard on the Turchino, because no one ever goes very hard there, and then go full gas down the descent, because if it's raining,
I've gone hard a couple of times in the little restaurant over the summit that serves a cracking cracking risotto.
Oh, really? Nice. Yeah. I would have liked to stop there. But,
anyway, go on. Sorry,
yeah,
go on.
Yeah, and then, you know, I mean, just because the descents in San Remo are technical. And so rain could definitely have an impact on that, because, yeah, then you're going to, positioning is even more crucial.
That's where I worry about Ganna. The descending of the Poggio. We haven't mentioned Pidcock either. I think he's obviously in good form.
Yeah. I think Ganna, if he's in the group, he doesn't have a problem. I think maybe if he's alone, he might have slightly more of an issue going as fast as, or catching guys that are perhaps in front of him.
Well, chaps, we should wrap it up. Do we want to do that with one name, one prediction? My prediction, I think, from the start of the year has been Laurence Pithy, although he hasn't raced since about 1974. So I don't know how he's going. But that was my... I'm sticking with that, Laurence Pithy, who went well, pretty well, last year in his first appearance. He was just outside the top 10.
I guess I can go for Pogacar. Why not? This might be his year.
Radical stuff. Lionel? Nothing from you.
No, nothing from me. I've listed
just
about
a scowl
15,
from
20, 15, 20 riders. Larry's point about the Turchino, though, I mean, that does extend the watching window by a good, few hours, doesn't it?
That could really... Larry's just really ruined everyone's Saturday.
It's unlikely it's going to happen, so don't worry about it. But
you've really ruined so many people's weekend now. Yeah. Chaps, it's been a delight. Thank you, Larry. Larry, we'll catch up with you soon. Just what's your race program?
I have a little break right now, and then I go to altitude, and then I do Tour of the Alps, and then we'll see. Hopefully we get an invite to the Giro. So if we get that, then I will hopefully go to the Giro, but we'll see.
What are they waiting for?
RCS have promised they'll let you know by the second rest day. Larry, perfect place for podcasting, Altitude. We've done it there before, so we'll catch up with you in a few weeks.
Excellent.
Thank you very much. Goodbye.
Daniel, I'll see you on Saturday for Arrivé.
Indeed. Look forward to it.
The Cycling Podcast was created in 2013 by Richard Moore, Daniel Freeb, and Lionel Burney.